show.
Hello, Wigglers. A big welcome to all you Little Toers. I'm Kirsten O'Brien, and you're listening to The Little Toe Show on Monday. And you know what that means. Are you ready? Socks off. Clean feet. It's time to wiggle. Hey, hang on. That was a double wiggle. What's going on? Ah, and no toes. I love a good old wiggle too, but we haven't got time for a double wiggle. We have a totally packed show for you with lots of great stories to get on with. All that as well as wiggling our toes. So come on, let's get started. We'll first head down to Wiggly Park to find out just how messy and sticky chewing gum can be. Moggy the caterpillar knows what I mean, and so will you in a few minutes if you stay right where you are. It's then time for Tilly Mint and the Dodo. In 20 minutes, we'll find out whether Tilly Mint finds Dodo in the dark and scary tunnels in the underground. Are you scared of the dark? Stay tuned to find out if Tilly is too. Then in about 30 minutes, we'll hear from Fergus Crane. He's found out that his teachers are not real teachers. They're actually pirates. And that's not all. We'll also follow Black Beauty on his new adventures in the classic story by Anna Sewell. Sorry, what was that, Toes? Oh, you want another wiggle? Oh, all right then, if you're quick. Oh, how great was that? I feel so much better now. And do you know what makes me feel even better? Listening to Wiggly Park. Now, I've got a question for you. What do you get if you add chewing gum together with Moggy from Wiggly Park? Well, it's a sticky mess. Such a mess that Moggy can't even speak. Why, I hear you ask? Well, let's find out now in Keith Faulkner's Wiggly Park.
Matt the milkman was sitting in the rose garden in Wiggly Park, enjoying a sandwich and a carton of fresh milk after his morning milk round.
Come on. Come on then, don't be shy,
he said as he scattered some crumbs from his sandwich onto the path. Over by the flower pot, EW and Nifty were watching, and they weren't very pleased. Not very pleased at all.
I say, I wish he'd jolly well stop doing that.
Yeah, there's enough blinking birds about without him making it worse.
Still, there is one good thing about it, Nifty.
Oh, yeah, what's that then, EW?
Ha ha! If those birds are full up with Matt's sandwich crumbs, they won't come looking for us, will they, eh?
As they were laughing together, Moggy, the fat caterpillar, came waddling down the path.
I say, watch out, Moggy, there are lots of birds about, ha!
But Moggy didn't seem at all put out.
Don't worry for my sake, dear. Birds don't bother me. They know better.
Yeah, I bet they do. They'd never be able to lift Moggy off the ground, not at her size,
whispered Nifty rudely to EW.
And don't think that I didn't hear that, young Nifty. A little respect for your betters wouldn't come amiss.
EW changed the subject.
Yes, what brings you to the rose garden this morning, Moggy?
Starvation, EW. It's hunger that brings me here. The vegetable garden is almost bare. There's hardly a thing left to eat. It's disgraceful.
Well, there's plenty of food about in the park if you wander about a bit.
That may be so. But if I go too far to find food, then by the time I get back, I'm hungry again.
I'll tell you what, Moggy, there's a nice big dandelion over in the corner there behind the bench. No one else knows about it except me.
Being so rude to you.
Oh, well, that's very thoughtful of you, Nifty. Perhaps you are learning your manners after all.
Moggy bowed graciously and waddled off at top speed to find the juicy dandelion. Sometime later, they saw Moggy coming back down the path towards them, looking rather distressed.
Oh, dear. What's the trouble, Moggy? Wasn't that dandelion any good?
Don't tell me someone else got there first.
The fat caterpillar stopped and began to mumble strangely. Neither E.W. nor Nifty could understand a single word. Come again, Moggy.
What's she going mum-mum-mum for? Can't she talk properly?
Moggy was getting more and more agitated all the time.
I don't get it, Nifty. She was all right a while ago. I said, you were all right a while ago.
E.W. bellowed at Moggy. He seemed to think that if she couldn't talk, then perhaps she couldn't hear very well either.
Oh, come on, let's find Shelley. Perhaps she'll be able to find out what the problem is.
So off they went to look for Shelley the French snail, with Moggy waddling behind and still mumbling wildly.
Ah, there she is. Shelley, cooey, Shelley.
Oh, E.W., Moggy, Nifty, how are you all?
Well, we're fine, as a matter of fact, Shelley, but there's something wrong with Moggy.
Oh, dear me. And what is the matter with you, Moggy? Moggy, I cannot understand what you're saying.
Yeah, that's the problem. Neither can we. We thought that you might know what's wrong with her.
Oh, just a moment. Let us have a look into her mouth.
And Shelley prized open Moggy's mouth and peered in.
Well, can you see anything?
Oh, mais oui, certainement. Look, I think that it is chewing gum. Yes, poor Moggy has eaten some chewing gum and it is sticking her mouth together.
Ah, right, yes. Oh, jolly well done. Now, how do we get it out? Yes, if we could get hold of it, perhaps, we could maybe pull it out. Yes, what do you think? We need to get a good grip on it, though.
Oh, I can do that all right, yeah. My jaws are jolly strong, they are.
So Nifty got a grip on the chewing gum sticking out of Moggy's mouth and began to pull. As he pulled, the gum stretched longer and longer.
I tell you what, Nifties, I'll wrap my tail around you, like this, and I'll pull too. We'll sort of pull together, what?
And the chewing gum got longer still.
Hold on to me, W. I can help as well.
All three of them now pulled and pulled, and the chewing gum stretched longer and longer, and suddenly there was an enormous plop, and they all fell back into a heap. Moggy's mouth was free again.
Oh, what a relief! I don't know how to thank you enough, my dears.
Shelley picked herself up.
Oh, we are just pleased to be able to help you, Moggy.
Yes, I say, it must have been awful with all that stuff stuck in your mouth, eh, Nifty?
But there was no reply from Nifty.
Nifty, I said, that sticky stuff must have been terrible for Moggy, mustn't it? What? Nifty? Nifty!
Repeated the earthworm.
Replied
the slug. His mouth was stuck together with the chewing gum.
Oh, Nifty, now you're gummed up too. Wiggly Park is written by Keith Faulkner and read by Andrew Sachs. And there'll be more from the gang tomorrow.
Listen out for a Wiggly show. It's on twice a day. Call Little Toe.
Little Toe.
Now, my Little Toe friends, it's time for Tilly Mint and the Dodo, written by Burley Doherty. Dodo has been rescued from the hunters by the mole rats, but Tilly Mint has to find her in the dark tunnels where the little creatures live. Just as well that Tilly Mint has magically turned into a lizard. But what lies ahead in those dark, echoey underground spaces?
It wasn't too bad at first. There was plenty of light filtering through to show her the way, and she could see the marks of little paws. But when she came to a bend in the tunnel, she was darting along in darkness. Who's that?
That!
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 A scared voice piped.
Me,
whispered Tilly, trying to stop the echoes bouncing.
Only mole rats allowed past this point, the mole rat guard said.
And dodos? Asked Tilly, hopefully. I believe I did see a dodo, the mole rat guard said. Bit fat for down here. She's my friend, said Tilly. Please let me go on. They'd be very upset if I let a lizard go down there. I could sing you a song instead. The mole rat's voice echoed round and round the dark tunnels, and while he was singing, Tilly crept past him down the main tunnel. She didn't stop until she saw a glow at the end of the tunnel. She realised that the tunnel swung round a bend and that the glow came from thousands of little insects shimmering along the tunnel walls and lighting up a large underground cavern. Dozens of mole rats were dancing round and singing away in high piping voices. Lying on her back in the middle of the ring, waving her legs about in time to the music, was Dodo. Tilly darted into the middle of the circle of dancing mole rats. Dodo! She cried. The mole rats froze in stillness. Did someone speak? I did, said Tilly. It's me. Oh, Dodo, I'm so glad you're still alive. Of course I'm still alive, said Dodo. I thought the hunters had shot you. I went a bit dizzy from being so high up, said Dodo. I fell off the tree and next thing I knew, these dear friends rescued me from the hunters. Tilly looked round and saw that the mole rats were standing in a line staring at her. Her heart started to thump in her throat. Hello, she said. I'm Tilly Mint, really. The largest mole rat was pure white, with big red eyes and fine whiskers. Hello, Tilly Mint, she said. Her voice was soft and silky. I'm the queen of the mole rats. I'm very pleased to meet you, Tilly Mint. But how did you get past the guard? Was he singing, Tilly Mint?
Yes. I thought so, the queen shouted. It is a very serious matter, she told Tilly. This is the great hall of mole rats. What will happen to us if our guard lets strangers through?
They could hear a slow dragging sound like someone limping, and soon, into the light, limped the guard, his head bent, his whiskers trailing in the dust.
Come here, guard, said the White Queen sternly.
I'm sorry, Queen, he said hoarsely.
You have failed us, old guard, the queen said softly. We could have been killed. Remember the time the hunters came with dogs?
Yes, queen.
Tell us what happened, old guard.
It was 4 or 5 summers ago, said the old guard.
Some hunters came to the island with dogs and guns. They shot many of our fine animals. They put many in cages to take away in boats to distant lands. All the creatures hid where they could, terrified for their lives, too frightened to go out for food. We mole rats came in our hundreds to this great hall, and then a dog came sneaking down one of the tunnels without any of us hearing him. As soon as he got to the great hall, he leapt on us, howling and clashing together his great yellow teeth. He sent all the mole rats fleeing for their lives down the tunnels, and outside all the entrances, men were waiting with guns to shoot us as we came out. Many were killed. The queen nodded. Can you remember how the hunter's dog got past the guard? The guard cleared his throat. The guard was asleep.
Exactly, said the queen.
His punishment, she announced, is that he will never be allowed to guard the mole rats again. Everyone nodded, even the old guard, at the justice of this punishment.
And what about his reward?
Demanded Dodo.
Reward? Said the queen. How can I reward him for what he did?
He helped Tilly to find me again.
And he's got a lovely singing voice, said Tilly.
Your reward, said the queen, is to take on the dangerous task of escorting Tilly Mint and the Dodo through the tunnels and back to daylight where they belong. Tilly Mint is a very special visitor from England. Look after her. And Dodo is the most precious creature on the island. She may well be the last of her kind.
Goodbye, Queen Mole Rat, said Tilly. Thank you very much for your help.
There is great danger ahead of you, the queen whispered. Beware of the pirates, Tilly Mint. She stood back and Tilly ran to catch up with Dodo and Mole Rat. hours they seemed to twist and twine through dark, damp tunnels. "I don't like it here much," said Tilly. "I don't like the darkness." That started poor old tired Mole Rat singing his favourite song. "All things begin in darkness, in shell, in nut, in hole, in seed, in spawn, in nest, in soil." And it was then that Tilly began to make out the beginning of daylight. It came like a tiny pinprick far away, and then the light came bursting through. The roof of the tunnel grew higher and higher, yet Tilly found she was having to stoop as she ran. And then she realised that she could see her own Tilly Mimp feet again in their stripy socks and shoes. Mole Rat looked up at Tilly. "You've grown a bit," he said anxiously. "You look a bit like a human now." "I am a human," said Tilly. "I'm a little girl." At last they were out of the tunnel. They seemed to be standing in a cave, and outside it they could hear the shush of the sea. Tilly ran out of the cave onto the yellow sands of a beach. "I don't suppose there's anything to eat round here, is there?" Mole Rat sniffed the sand. "I've left all my food behind." "What do you eat, Mole Rat?" asked Tilly. "Bulbs and roots and things," Mole Rat sighed. "And lovely juicy worms." "I'll see what I can find," Tilly promised him. "You stay here and watch Dodo, won't you? She looks tired out after all that excitement." She clambered up a steep bank that led out of the little cove where Mole Rat and Dodo had stretched themselves out to sleep. "Don't go away from there, will you?" she called to them. Tilly went into the jungle to search for food. She was very hungry herself. She had no idea what a dodo might eat. The trees were heavy with all sorts of fruits, and as she reached up to pick some, Tilly saw a flying squirrel leap off one high branch onto another tree. Another one cast off after it. They perched together on a branch and looked out across to the little cove where Tilly had been. More and more of them clustered on the branch, pointing to something far out to sea. They seemed to be saying something urgent to each other, and what they said came down like a whisper in the air, and seemed to be taken up again and floated off by humming insects, and drifted down again and whistled softly by slow-flying birds. The further Tilly went into the bushes, the greater the fluttering and whispering grew, till it seemed that the air of the island was buzzing with the same sad song. "All the poor dodos, all the poor dodos, all the poor dodos." "What do you mean?" Tilly shouted. "What's happening?" A blue-green bird with golden eyes and a voice like a bell flew down and fluttered its wings rapidly so it hovered just over Tilly's head. "Danger around, danger everywhere," it chimed. "Pirate ship sailing, beware, beware." "A pirate ship!" Tilly dropped all the fruit she'd been gathering. "Get back to her," the chiming bird urged. "Back to her!" Tilly ran back to the cove, pushing her way through trailing bushes, her breath throbbing in her throat. Far out on the horizon she could see the riggings of a tall sailing ship. But when she came to the edge of the little bay she could only stand, helpless, staring at the place where Dodo and the Mole Rat had been lying. Because both of them had gone.
Tilly Mint and the Dodo is written by Burley Dorsey and read by Jenny McAlpine, and there's another part coming up in a few minutes' time. Hey, little toes, what programme are we listening to again?
We're always wiggling on Little Toe.
Oh, yes, that's right. And I'm Kirsten O'Brien, right here with you on BBC Seven. Are you having a good time? I thought so, but it'll get even better. Soon we'll hear the final part of Tilly Mint and the Dodo. We'll also find out what Fergus Crane does when he finds out that his teachers are pirates. What would you do? I'd be so scared. And we're also galloping away with Black Beauty in about 20 minutes.
Tee-haw! Tee-haw! Stop! Stop! Wiggly!
want to hear a poem next? Well, which poem do you want to listen to? Oh, I love that one too. It's called The Little Blue Lion and it's written by Chris White. And I'm going to read it to you now.
Many, many miles away, where the land is hard and dry, and there's no escape from the sun burning in the sky, there is a pride of lions living there together. They eat and sleep and live their lives, enjoying the good weather. Most of the lions are happy, except one little guy. The other lions don't like him much. Let me tell you why. They laugh and point and snigger. They shout names at him too. The reason he gets picked on is his fur is coloured blue. Whilst all the other lions are golden, with a brownish mane, for some reason, we don't know why, this lion is not the same. When he takes a stroll through the jungle, the hyenas stop and laugh, and it's a great big pain in the neck to be ridiculed by a giraffe. It makes the little lion cry. He doesn't think it's fair that he should be picked on because he's got different hair. Then, one day, a bright red parrot squawked down from her nest.
I think you should be quite pleased. You don't look like the rest.
Yes, you're right. It's not my fault that I'm blue, not brown. From now on, I'll ignore the taunts. I won't take this lion down. From this day on, I'll stand up tall and roar my message loud. I like the fact that I am blue. I stand out in a crowd. Besides, it's not my colour, but the lion I am inside. When I walk through the jungle, I'll wear my fur with pride. And now the other animals don't laugh when he walks by, because the little blue lion holds his little blue head high. Whereas before they'd shout and point and call him a blue freak, now he's the main attraction. He's one of a kind. He's unique.
That was a poem by Chris White called The Little Blue Lion.
Wiggly, 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 wiggly,
wiggly. Oh, hang on, my toes are whispering something else to me. I'm just going to see what they want. Hold on. Ah, what did you say? Speak up, I can't hear you. Oh, you want to wiggle again? Well, go on then, go on, wiggle away. Oh, that's much better, don't you think? Let's sit back now and listen to more from our story, Tilly Mint and the Dodo, written by Burley Doherty. Tilly Mint has been looking for food in the jungle, but when she returns to the beach, Dodo and the Mole Rat have vanished. What has happened to them? Where have they gone? Tilly Mint is sure they're in danger, but can she save them from the pirates?
Tilly stood at the top of the bank, gazing down at the place where she'd last seen Dodo and Mole Rat. I'll never see them again, she thought. She felt a feather tickling her leg and realised that they were standing right next to her.
Where have you been? She shouted. I wanted to go for a little walk and Mole Rat came with me, said Dodo.
I was worried, Dodo, said Tilly.
I thought something was after you.
There's usually something after me, Dodo agreed.
I'm very popular.
Don't be silly, Dodo. Why can't they leave you alone?
I don't think they ever will.
Then it's not fair, said Tilly. It's just not fair. The world belongs to all of us.
Some people just don't seem to want to share it,
Dodo said sadly.
Tilly, I've got a very special present. I want you to take it back to England and show it to all the children there. And to people who love animals. Oh, and birds, and fishes, and flowers, and trees. All the people who want to share their world with them. I'm not going without you, Dodo.
I think you may have to, Dodo turned away.
I'll go and fetch it now.
She waddled away into the trees again.
But where's she gone?
Asked Tilly. She's gone to a nesting place, said Mole Rat. It's where the dodos used to lay their eggs, only not now. None left, you see. Mole Rat scrabbled up the bank and followed Dodo back into the jungle. Tilly sat down wearily. Suddenly she heard the sound of voices across the water. A rowing boat pulled into shore. Two men climbed out, one tall and one short, one old and one young. As soon as she saw their swarthy faces and rich clothing, Tilly knew they were pirates. Never, never had she felt so afraid. The tallest one had a long, tufty black beard. Tilly crouched down. "Keep away, Dodo," she thought. Blackbeard began to shout angrily over his shoulder, "I'm hungry!" Pirate lad sniffed. He beckoned to Blackbeard. "Do you smell what I smell, brother? There's a dodo in the air." "Oh, no," gasped Tilly. He dropped down onto his knees to examine the sand. "And look at this! Dodo tracks!" Blackbeard leaned down over him and nodded slowly. "What wouldn't I give, brother, for a dish of dodo stew?" Completely forgetting her fear, Tilly stood up and shouted as hard as she could, "Run, Dodo! Run for your life!" Blackbeard grabbed her and hauled her down on the beach again. The pirates stood each side of her. "You know where that bird is! You're hiding it from us!"
"She's the only one left! Leave her!" Tilly begged.
"Tell us where to find it!"
"I'm here,"
came Dodo's voice, calm and quiet behind them. The pirates froze. Dodo stepped forward. She held an egg in her folded wings and she nodded to Tilly to come and take it from her. And in a voice that was as soft as a whisper, Dodo sang her the only song she knew, the song of the last Dodo. "This is the egg, the golden egg, the special egg from long ago. Take it back to England, for children there to know. For children who love animals, in air, on earth, in sea. Who keep the forest places for creatures to roam free. For children who let flowers grow, and butterfly and bee. Who leave the fishes in their stream, and leave the spiders on their web. And leave the birds' eggs in their nest, and leave the beetle on its log. This lovely living planet belongs to everything that moves and breathes upon it. A song of life I sing. So take this egg and keep it safe in memory of the life and death of the last Dodo." Tilly knew then that this was the last time she would ever see Dodo. She tried to rush forward to hug her, but jungle creatures closed in a ring round Dodo and the pirates, keeping Tilly back. Mole rats, lizards, snakes, monkeys, flying squirrels, grey-hooded birds and red firebirds. Insects and all kinds of creatures that Tilly had never seen before, all clustering round Dodo and the pirates, all bowing their heads in silence. For that was a terrible day, when the last of the Dodos was killed by pirates. And it happened a long time ago. And when the animals moved away, the pirates had gone. So had Dodo. But Tilly could hear the splash of oars on the sea and the cruel laughter of the pirate brothers as they rowed back to their ship. Far out on the horizon, she could see the pirate ship moored with little lanterns swinging on it. Tilly was alone. "I want to go home," said Tilly. "I want to go home." Then the wind of the night came rushing up to her and lifted her as if she had no weight at all and carried her like a speck of dream dust. "Dodos are like dinosaurs. They're all dead now," over and over again in her mind. And then one voice kept coming through, stronger than others and closer than them. "It's no good crying over dead dodos. Crying won't bring them back." She knew that voice. "Mrs. Hardcastle! Mrs. Hardcastle!" she called. Now she could see right down through treetops. She was looking down inside the biggest tree in the forest, and there was Mrs. Hardcastle, yawning and rubbing her eyes as if she was just waking up from a sleep. "Mrs. Hardcastle!" Tilly could hear her own voice, far away, as if it was in a dream. "Oh, Mrs. Hardcastle, I want to tell you! The island, and the big hunters, and the pirates came! Oh, and the dodo, Mrs. Hardcastle, the dodo, did it really, really happen?" and though she was whirling round so fast now that she couldn't see Mrs. Hardcastle any more, she could hear her voice, as close to her ear as if she was up in the sky next to her. Yes, it all really happened, Tilly, a long time ago. Tell the children, Tilly Mint, tell the children. Captain Cloud will help you. And Mrs. Hardcastle's voice grew fainter and fainter. And the whirl of the wind tossed Tilly gently till she felt as if she were being rocked in a little boat on a lapping stream. And she could hear the sound of someone singing about jellyfish.
Proper little squelchy things, blobs of slime, pink and purple bubbles like dancers in the brine.
And she knew that any minute now the rocking would stop and she would come up with a bump against the wall of Captain Cloud's boat shed. She opened her eyes. She was lying in bed, with Mr. Pig tucked under the pillow.
"Awake at last," Mum laughed.
She sat on Tilly's bed.
"What a night it's been, Tilly. All that wind. And you didn't sleep very well, did you? I heard you shouting out for Mrs. Hardcastle."
Tilly stared out of the window. She was sure. Sure. "Tilly," said Mum gently. "Mrs. Hardcastle isn't going to come back again. You know that, don't you?" Tilly nodded. "I went round to her house last night," Mum said. "I wanted to help her brother clear out the attic, and we found something that we thought you'd like to keep. You were fast asleep when I brought it in, Tilly, so I put it there for you. Look, on your special shelf."
"The egg! It's my egg!"
Tilly gasped. It was big as a melon and yellow with age. She picked it up carefully.
"Captain Cloud thought you'd like it," said Mum. "I don't know what it is, though, do you?"
"Yes," said Tilly.
"It's a special egg, a magic egg from long ago. I'll keep it safe in memory of the life and death of the last dodo."
"Mum," she said, "I want to tell all the children about the dodo. Do you think Captain Cloud would help me?"
"I'm sure he would," said Mum.
After breakfast, Tilly went to Captain Cloud's house, and she told him the story of the last of the dodos.
"That's a very important story, Tilly," he told her when she'd finished. "I'll tell you what. I'll fetch some paper and a pencil, and we'll make it into a book, shall we?"
And that is exactly what they did.
Oh, I was enjoying that. That was the last part of Tilly Mint and the Dodo. It was written by Burley Doherty and read by Jenny McAlpine. And it was abridged especially for Little Till by June Mitchell.
You see, there's still more stories left.
This is our show, the show for us little toers. All big-toed people can listen to the Big Toe Radio Show every day at 4 o'clock, right here on BBC 7. It's for slightly older children, and it's just as packed with fun and great stories. OK, let's carry on the show and start our next story. Fergus has just found out that his teachers aren't really teachers at all. They're really pirates who left his father deserted on Fire Island. What's Fergus going to do now? Here's the next part of Fergus Crane, written by Paul Stewart and Chris Riddell.
"Look what the fateful Voyage Trading Company sent this time, Fergus," his mother laughed. "Penguin paper chains! And another big money order, and the nicest letter. It said I was their most reliable worker ever." Fergus smiled, but his uncle's parting words were ringing round his head. "You must go to school tomorrow and warn your friends. Then you must all leave and never go back. And Fergus, dear boy, don't breathe a word of this to your mother. She mustn't be upset."
"I won't," Fergus had promised, climbing onto the flying horse. Fergus awoke to the sound of his alarm clock and hurriedly got dressed. He had to get to school to warn his classmates. He rushed downstairs and waved to his mother through Beiderbecker's window, then ran full pelt. Perhaps it was the running, perhaps the lack of breakfast, or the excitement of the last few days. But as he raced towards the quayside, Fergus began to get a distinctly strange, fluttery feeling in his stomach. It was only when he reached the quay that he realised why. The Betty Jean wasn't there. The sign was still in place, beside the large mooring ring, the school ship Betty Jean. But pasted to the sign was a notice. School trip. Back in 6 weeks.
Oh, no,
groaned Fergus. Bolivia had tried to warn him.
Rot! Don't come to school tomorrow,
she had squawked. But he'd ignored her warnings, and now it was too late. Captain Claw had set sail for Fire Isle and taken his classmates with him. None of them had any idea what awaited them in the Emerald Sea. But Fergus did. The flutter in his stomach gave way to boiling, furious anger. Captain Claw and his pirate henchmen were not going to get away with it. Turning away, Fergus marched purposefully back in the direction of Boulevard Archduke Ferdinand. What was he going to do? What would the great adventurer Captain Marcus Crane have done? Or Uncle Theo, for that matter? Uncle Theo! He'd know what to do. He must let Uncle Theo know that the Betty Jean had sailed. But how? Uncle Theo was miles away, high in the mountains. The box! Shouted Fergus. Of course, the box! Fergus dashed to his apartment. Back in his bedroom, his trembling fingers closed over the little box. The damaged wing hung limply, but the other one looked fine and the key was still in place. Examining the wing closely, Fergus noticed that several of the tiny struts beneath its papery surface had been snapped. He went to the kitchen, returning with sticky tape and a box of kitchen safety matches. Carefully snapping a match to the right length, he fashioned a small splint, which he attached to the underside of the wing with the sticky tape. The wing was certainly better than it had been. But would it fly? Fergus pressed the top of the box and the little silver pencil popped up. He tore out the title page of Practical Potholing for Beginners and wrote beneath the title, Dear Uncle Theo, the Betty Jean has sailed. I must save my friends. What can I do? Please help. Signed, your long-lost nephew, Fergus. He popped the paper inside the box and clicked the door shut. Then he wound the key. All Fergus could do now was hope. He crossed to the window and released the little box. The tiny wings beat a little lopsidedly, but the splint seemed to be working. The little box flew high above the town and on towards the far-off mountains until Fergus lost sight of it. At 8 that evening, Fergus's mother came home. Fergus was in the sitting room. Fergus, it's the strangest thing, she said excitedly. Sylvie Smith's mother was in the shop this afternoon. She says her Sylvie has gone on a school trip for 6 weeks.
I was going to tell you about that, Fergus began. I missed the boat.
Well, that's not your fault, interrupted Mrs. Crane. From what Mrs. Smith was saying, the school gave no one any notice. They just upped and left. And the oddest thing, Fergus, just before Mrs. Smith came into Beiderbecker's, a parcel arrived outside the shop window. Mr. Luscombe from the umbrella shop swears he saw it being delivered by a low-flying Canada goose, of all things. If you ask me, the man's a bit cracked in the head. Anyway, there was a parcel there, all right, sitting on the pavement and addressed to me. And here it is. Mrs. Crane flourished a large padded envelope, and Fergus's heart leaped as he saw the label on its front. The Fateful Voyage Trading Company. There's a letter inside, along with another money order, said Mrs. Crane excitedly. And Fergus, listen to this! His mother cleared her throat and began. Dear Mrs. Lucia Crane, it has been brought to our attention that you have a son of school age. As the son of one of our most valued workers, we would like to offer him the Fateful Voyage Trading Company scholarship. As one of our scholarship boys, we would be delighted if he could come and spend some time at the Fateful Voyage Trading Company headquarters here on Overlook Mountain. both to learn more about the company and to meet us in person. If the answer is yes, please tick the box and travel arrangements will be made. Yours with every best wish, Finn, Bill and Jackson, Vice Presidents, the Fateful Voyage Trading Company. Well, dear, said Mrs. Crane, would you like to go? Fergus smiled triumphantly. You try and stop me, he said. That night, the flying box returned, its wing as good as new, with a message. Dear Fergus, I'm making conventional travel arrangements as it wouldn't do to draw too much attention at this stage. Your mother must not be upset. Affectionately, your newfound Uncle Theo. 2 days later, an envelope arrived with a train ticket and a timetable and a letter for Mrs. Crane. Thank you for allowing your son to visit Overlook Mountain. Please ensure he has a change of clothes and a waterproof jacket. We will arrange for him to be met at Snowy Peak Junction. Best wishes, Finn, Bill and Jackson, Vice Presidents, the Fateful Voyage Trading Company. Mrs. Crane waved Fergus goodbye at the station. The train wound its way round the coast and, with a loud whistle, rattled into the long, dark tunnel through the mountains. The journey seemed so much longer by train than by flying horse, Fergus thought, but he had plenty of sandwiches and a thermos of hot chocolate in his backpack, and besides, there was so much to think about. Finally, early the next morning, Fergus woke to find the little train chugging into Snowy Peak Junction, and there, waiting for him on the platform, were Uncle Theo and the penguins.
Fergus, my dear boy!
Uncle Theo exclaimed as Fergus climbed down from the train.
Breakfast is ready and waiting for us in the gallery. Come, we have important plans to make.
Far below Fergus, as the flying horse soared on, was an endless expanse of slate-grey ocean. Cold, misty air swirled round him. Sometimes the cloud thickened and the horse would fly up above it, its silvery hooves seeming to gallop over the fluffy white drifts. Sometimes the sky cleared and Fergus had to cling on tightly round the flying horse's neck as it swooped back down towards the sea. He saw their own shadow flitting across the rolling surface as they passed overhead. Whichever way he looked, left, right, behind and ahead, the mighty ocean continued unbroken to the horizon. Fergus trembled. He was completely and utterly alone. If anything should happen to the flying horse, then he and it would be lost forever, swallowed up without a trace by the endless ocean. It had felt so different that bright sunny morning when Uncle Theo had waved him off from the mountain chalet. The old inventor had spent the previous 2 weeks working on the flying horse, poring over the charts the scuttlebug had provided and adjusting the mechanism in the creature's great metal head. Fergus had spent most of the time with Finn, Bill and Jackson in the greenhouses, learning all about the art of growing macadaccio nuts. In addition, Fergus practiced flying the winged horse.
"You're a natural, my boy!" Uncle Theo had laughed at the end of the first week, as Fergus and the horse came gently back to earth.
"I think we can lose this now." He removed the "Do not touch" sign from the reins.
"It's all yours, my boy."
For the following week, Fergus had the time of his life as he mastered swooping dips, wheeling turns and hair-raising loop-the-loops, all at a flick of the reins. Finally, the day of departure had arrived.
"Fergus," Uncle Theo had said sternly, "I've done all I can. The horse will take you to Fire Isle. If the Betty Jean is there, then you must go straight to Captain Claw and offer him the scuttlebug in return for the safety of your classmates. He might be a black-hearted pirate, but he's no fool. He'll realize that the scuttlebug will do the job every bit as well as your poor comrades ever could, tunnel exercise or no tunnel exercise."
Will Fergus make it to Fire Isle in time to save his friends? Find out in the next part of Fergus Crane by Paul Stewart and Chris Riddell. It's read by Stephen Kinman.
Aha, that was lovely.
Oh, I do hope things work out for Fergus Crane. Let's keep our fingers and toes crossed for him. Oh, actually, that's easier said than done. It's really tricky. Ooh, have you ever tried crossing your toes? I can't do it. Hang on, let me try again. No, I can't. It is really hard work. Oh, what's that, toes? Oh, you're saying you're not flexible enough and you're getting all in a tangle. I'll tell you what then, let's all sit back and relax and listen to another story. I know you can do that very well. It's the next part of Anna Sewell's story, Black Beauty. After 3 happy years with Squire Gordon, the family have to move abroad, and so Black Beauty and Ginger are sold to the Earl of Whitcomb.
The next morning after breakfast, John put the saddle on Ginger and the leading rein on me and rode us across the country about 15 miles to Earlshall Park, where the Earl of Whitcomb lived. There was a very fine house and a great deal of stabling. We went into the yard through a stone gateway, and John asked for Mr. York. Mr. York was a fine-looking middle-aged man. He called a groom, and we were taken to a light, airy stable and placed in boxes adjoining each other, where we were rubbed down and fed. In about half an hour, John and Mr. York, who was to be our new coachman, came in to see us.
"Now, Mr. Manley," he said, "we all know that horses have their peculiarities. Is there anything particular you'd like to mention?"
"Well," said John, "I'd better say that we've never used the check rein with either of them."
"Well," said York, "here they must wear it. My lady will have style, and if her carriage horses aren't reined up tight, she won't look at them."
"I'm very sorry for that," said John. He came round to each of us to pat us for the last time. I held my face close to him. That was all I could do to say goodbye. And then he was gone. I've never seen him since.
The next afternoon we were harnessed, put in the carriage, and led round to the front of the house. 2 footmen in livery were standing ready. Presently, we heard the rustling of silk as my lady came down the flight of stone steps. She stepped round to look at us. She was a tall, proud-looking woman, and didn't seem pleased.
"York, you must put those horses' heads higher. They aren't fit to be seen."
York came round to our heads and shortened the rein. 1 hole, I think. Every little makes a difference. And that day we had a steep hill to go up. Of course, I wanted to put my head forward and take the carriage up with a will, as we'd been used to. But no, I had to pull with my head up now, and the strain came on my back and legs. Day by day, hole by hole, our bearing rings were shortened, and soon I began to dread having my harness put on. Then one day my lady came down later than usual.
"Drive to the Duchess of Bellingham," she said. "And York, are you never going to get those horses' heads up? Raise them at once, and let's have no more of this nonsense."
York came to me first, while the groom stood at Ginger's head. He drew my head back and fixed the rein so tight that it was almost unbearable. Then he went to Ginger. She had a good idea of what was coming, and the moment York took the rein off the terret in order to shorten it, she began plunging, rearing and kicking. At last, she kicked right over the carriage pole and fell down. York promptly sat himself down flat on her head to prevent her struggling, at the same time calling out, "Unbuckle the black horse!" The groom soon set me free from Ginger and the carriage and led me to my box where I stood, my head still strained up to the terret. Before long, Ginger was led in by 2 grooms, a good deal knocked about and bruised. York came with her and then came to look at me. In a moment he let down my head. Lord Whitcomb was much put out when he learned what had happened. Ginger was never put into the carriage again. But when she was well of her bruises, one of Lord Whitcomb's younger sons said he'd like to have her. He was sure she'd make a good hunter. As for me, I was obliged still to go in the carriage and had a fresh partner called Max. He'd always been used to the tight rein. I asked him how he bore it.
"I bear it because I must," he said. "But it's shortening my life."
What I suffered with that rein for 4 long months in my lady's carriage, it would be hard to describe. Each time I returned from my work, my neck and chest were strained and painful, my mouth and tongue tender. I'm quite sure that had it lasted much longer, either my health or my temper would have given way. Early in the spring, Lord Whitcomb and part of his family went up to London. The Lady Harriet, who remained at the Hall, was an invalid and never went out in the carriage. The Lady Anne preferred riding on horseback with her brother or cousins. She was a perfect horsewoman, as gentle as she was beautiful. She chose me for her horse. I enjoyed these rides very much in the clear, cold air, sometimes with Ginger, sometimes with Lizzie, a bright bay mare, a great favourite with the gentleman on account of her fine action and lively spirit. There was a gentleman of the name of Blantyre staying at the Hall. He always rode Lizzie, and praised her so much that one day Lady Anne ordered the side saddle to be put on her and the other saddle on me. When we came to the door, the gentleman seemed very uneasy. "What's this?" he said. "Are you tired of your horse?" "Not at all, but I'll let you ride him for once, and I'll try your charming Lizzie."
"Oh, please don't," he said. "She's a charming creature, but she's too nervous for a lady."
Lady Anne laughed.
"Don't trouble your head about me. I've been a horsewoman since I was a baby."
There was no more to be said. He placed her carefully on Lizzie and then mounted me. Just as we were moving off, a footman came out with a slip of paper and a message from Lady Harriet.
"Would they ask this question for her at Dr. Ashley's and bring the answer?"
The village was about a mile off. When we came to his gate, Blantyre alighted and was going to open it for Lady Anne, but she said, "I'll wait for you here." He hung my rein on one of the iron spikes and walked to the house. Lizzie stood quietly by the side of the road, her back to me. There was a meadow on the opposite side of the road, and just then several young colts came trotting out, while a boy behind was cracking a great whip. One of the colts bolted across the road and blundered up against Lizzie's hind legs. She gave a violent kick and dashed off into a headlong gallop, nearly unseating Lady Anne. I gave a loud, shrill neigh for help. Again and again I neighed, tossing my head to get the rein loose. Soon, Blantyre came running to the gate and caught sight of the flying figure. In an instant, he sprang to the saddle. I needed no whip nor spur, for I was as eager as my rider. He saw it and gave me a free rein, and we dashed after them. For about 3 miles, we scarcely gained ground upon them. Finally, we reached the common. About halfway across the heath, a wide dyke had recently been cut. With scarcely a pause, Lizzie took the leap. Stumbling among the rough clods of the bank on the other side, she fell. Blantyre gave me a steady rein. I gathered together, and with one determined leap, cleared both dyke and bank. Motionless among the heather lay my poor young mistress. Blantyre dismounted, kneeled down, and gently he turned her face upward. It was a ghastly white. At no great distance, 2 men had been cutting turf. They came running up, asking what they could do. Glantyre turned to one. Mount this horse, my friend, ride to the doctor's, and ask him to come instantly. Then go on to the hall and bid them send me the carriage with some help. I'll stay here. Two days after the accident, Glantyre paid me a visit with Lord George. He patted me and praised me very much. He told Lord George that he was sure the horse knew of Annie's danger as well as he did. I found by their conversation that my young mistress was now out of danger and would soon be able to ride again, and I was very happy.
Once again, Black Beauty saves the day. Listen tomorrow to find out what happens when Black Beauty is treated badly by his groom. Oh, that doesn't sound very nice. The story was written by Anna Sewell and read by John Hasler, and you can catch the next part around the same time on Little Toad tomorrow.
Ooh, I do like a little wiggle.
Ooh, I'm a bit chilly. It's quite cold in the studio today. I think I need to put on another jumper. Are you cold, Little Toes? Well, I suppose you wouldn't be with the amount of wiggling you've been doing today. You know, being chilly reminds me of a poem I know. It's called I'm Cold, and it's written and read by Ian McMillan.
I'm cold. I'm cold. I'm colder than a really cold thing. Come over here and listen to me sing I'm Cold. Colder than a fridge in the snow, colder than the cold winds blow, colder than an icicle's house, colder than an Arctic mouse, colder than a block of ice, colder than something that's been frozen twice. I'm cold, I'm cold, I'm colder than a really cold thing. Come over here and listen to me sing, I'm cold. Colder than a snowman's toes, colder than Jack Frost's nose, colder than Santa's sack, colder than a polar bear's back, colder than a frozen sea, colder than you if you're as cold as me. I'm cold, I'm cold, I'm colder than a really cold thing. Come over here and listen to me sing, I'm cold. Colder than December late nights, colder than sitting in starlight, colder than a freezing shower, colder than the midnight hour, colder than a drink with ice in. I'm cold, that's not surprising. I'm cold, I'm cold, I'm colder than a really cold thing. Come over here and listen to me sing, I'm cold.
That very cold poem was written and read by Ian McMillan, and it was called simply, I'm Cold. Now, I'm afraid I've some bad news for you now. I know, we don't like bad news, do we? But the truth is, it's soon time for Little Toad to be over for now. Boo! But I have got good news too. Little Toad is back tomorrow, and we'll be packed with more great stories and loads of toe wiggling. Hooray! So, shall we all get together and wiggle our toes one last time for now? Hey, if there are any big toes out there, you're welcome to join us too, you know, just this once. So, here we go.
On satellite channel 0131, this is BBC 7.
Hello there, how are you? Long time no speak. It's Michaela Saunders here and welcome to Monday Morning on 7. My thanks for the early start from the Little Toes. And for the next hour, it's Silly Moments all the way with myself and Alex Riley. It's breakfast at BBC 7.
This is the radio texting service. You have received a text message from BBC 7.
I'm Alex Riley. Listen to the BBC 7 Comedy Club. In April, I'll have great programs such as Flight of the Conchords.